Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the literary world. My guest today is author James Ross, and I have to admit that this is a gentleman that I have been wanting to sit down with for some considerable time. James, welcome to the lair.
Hi, Simon. Thanks for having me.
Maybe we could start off with a little biographical information. Exactly who is James Ross?
Just a Midwestern kid that grew up in the middle part of America. This is where my roots are, and I've been a person that's been enjoying life and living life. I reached the middle part of it, and I had a story to tell.
Okay. Did you just sort of sit bolt upright in bed one morning and say, that's it, I've got it, I'm going to write a book?
Well, I think as we all live life and experience life and meet different people and become exposed to different things, we either can relate those experiences or know some things that have happened to other people or dream up things. And this story, my first story, was one that I had concocted, and it had a lot of twists and turns to it, so I was relaying these things to a doctor buddy of mine, and he said, you know, that would make a good movie. And being a movie watcher, I kind of agreed with him, and I just let that comment register. Then after thinking about it for a year or so, we had gone on a golf outing, and on the way back, I said to my doctor friend, I said, you know, today's the day I'm going to start that movie. He looked at me and said, what movie? And I said, that movie that you told me about that story that I had. I said, I'm going to write the screenplay. So I went on to the internet, did some research, got into a screenwriting club, purchased some software, and sat down to write a movie, of all things.
And I guess at some point you decided that movie wasn't quite the right direction?
Simon, I thought it was a masterpiece. I mean, that was $1 million script I thought that I had. 2-hour full-length feature movie. So I submitted it to an analyst and had it analyzed, or a consultant at the screenwriting club, and it came back with so much red ink, I immediately got discouraged. So, you know, my first baby was slaughtered. So we sat down and we thought, you know, how can we make this thing better? Well, we rewrote it another 2 or 3 times, but it was agreed that I had the characters and the plot and the storyline to continue. So I hired a Hollywood consultant, and we rewrote that screenplay another 10 times, I believe, until it really got decent. Probably not up to Hollywood standards yet, but then I asked him, I said, how am I going to be able to sell this screenplay? And he said, 2 words, the book. I turned to, his name was Jim as well, I turned to him, I said, Jim, I don't want to write a book. He said, well, you asked me. So I took that, you know, I thought about it for about 3 months, trying to get motivated to go into prose, and then I decided I didn't have anything else to do. I still had this story that needed to be told, so I used the screenplay as my outline for the book, and that's how Lifetime Loser came about.
Why did you select the golf background?
You know, when we grew up in the suburbs of St. Louis, we moved to a golf community, My dad put a golf club in our hands when my brother and I, when we were, you know, 9, 10, 11 years old. And that was the sport that we came to love. And because we spent a lot of time on the golf course growing up and in also in our adult years, that's the thing that is my comfort zone. That's where the guys are that I can relate to. So that's how that setting came about.
So you are pretty much an avid golfer yourself.
And a big sports fan as well.
A big sports fan. Actually, about a week ago, I was chatting with another author, and we were just shooting the breeze about, you know, authors in general. And it turned out this guy really enjoyed reading Dick Francis books. And I have to admit, in the back of my mind, I started drawing parallels. You know, Dick writes about horses and horse racing, and all of your books are very golf-oriented. However, Dick has this very fixed formula. The hero gets beaten up the first time around page 75. He recovers and takes another good beating around about page 150 and wins the day around page 200. You, however, do not run with a formula. All of your books are completely different. You have that same backdrop, the Prairie Winds golf course, and you include many of the same characters, and yet each book heads in a completely different direction. Was this a conscious decision that you made?
First of all, Simon, the golf course setting is my comfort zone, so I can always come back into that. The it's really weird. Somebody asked me how I can write, because when I sit down, it really starts flowing very easily. But it's sort of like I'm on the ceiling fan in the room, and I'm just hovering above all the action, and then it's more or less a reporting sort of an issue. But I can see the people. I can imagine them. I actually see them. I see them doing all the things that they're doing, and I see them. I hear their conversation, and I'm there. So it's very easy for me to write about it. But as far as the formula goes, I think the most enjoyable part of it for me is creating the characters. I've lived a very diverse life. I've had an opportunity to meet a lot of different people. And I think as an observer of life and people, I take a little bit here and a little bit there and then just more or less report it. And that's what brings me the enjoyment. Now, whether or not the plot line, comes on page 75 and then something happens on 150 or something else happens on 250, I'm not really conscious of that when I'm writing. I'm just telling the story.
Right, and my point to this author was, you know, you do not operate that way. I mean, your storylines are so completely different. And when you compare, actually, let's go back to your first book, Lifetime Loser. And why don't you give us a thumbnail sketch about it?
Well, Simon, how that all came about was, believe it or not, when the old J. Simpson trial was going and the Goldman family was there, and we were all watching that on TV. We had the decision that came out of the court system criminally, and he was acquitted, and then the Goldman family had to go into court, and the civil side awarded a $32 million judgment. And that was when I really started thinking. I said, you know, how in the world can you have the same set of facts and have two so opposite rulings? And that's the criminal justice system versus the civil justice system. And so I concocted this story about this despicable character that was committing a crime that the government really or law enforcement really didn't want to solve. However, his despicable actions affected a lot of people civilly. And that's sort of what Lifetime Loser is all about.
Yeah, in fact, Lifetime Loser, I had never heard that comment by you before about it, you know, being inspired, if you will, by O.J. But yeah, I mean, it's very much a legal eagle type book. You have these really villainous villains, and you know the hero that has to battle through it. Great book, and very enjoyable. And then you followed it up with Finish Line, I believe. This time, rather than picking on J.W. Schroeder, you select his brother Kurt, and you created almost a coming-of-age book, although I use the term coming-of-age in a very non-traditional way. I mean, it's at a tangent from Lifetime Loser. Tell us a little bit about Finish Line.
The odd thing happened when Lifetime Loser was completed. After working on it for 8 months, then we got into the editing and proofing stage, and that took another 3 or 4 months, and then we had to work with the publisher and finally bring the product to market. But while all this was happening, I stopped writing. But the characters are screaming for another story. So in Finish Line, essentially, because of my love for creating characters, I looked at another fabric of society, which is, to me, divorce and broken homes. And two teenage boys, essentially lacking a little bit of direction, end up getting in some mischief. They've got to pay a penalty. But it just so happened that their penalty meant a little hard work on the golf course and becoming involved with some people that they never knew existed in their life up until then. So Finish Line, as you well know, is probably more of a book for YA readers or teenage boys. And even though it was written for adults, I did that just to show a little diversity and show that I could go back and go into that teenage level.
I have to admit that I won't say I was shocked, but I'm a person that reads a lot of books, and quite often I will read several books by the same author, and you kind of get. You kind of get a feeling for what you're up against. And I don't mean that in a bad way. But, I mean, Finish Line was so completely different from Lifetime Loser. I put it down after I'd finished it, and I went, is this the same guy?
And thank you for that. I'm going to take that as a compliment from you. But what I tried to create with Finish Line Simon was the family that I have created in my mind that is living at Prairie Winds Golf Course, which is the setting for my stories. And I wanted to show the love that everybody had for each other.
I think you did it admirably, by the way.
Virtually all the characters were male characters, but they are good buddies. They go to bat for each other. They're friends with each other. And here are these two teenage boys that entered that life. And, whether or not it's an adventure, whether or not it's a whatever you want to call it, that's what I wanted to portray in Finish Line, and obviously then we had a villain in that, which I'd rather have the reader read about, but everybody in that clubhouse was exposed to that villain, or was aware of that villain, and we saw how that was handled, but that was how Finish Line came about.
Okay, and then your next release was Chewie's Course, and I've got to admit, I picked the book up, and I already had in my mind, I have no clue where James Ross is going to take me on this adventure, and I was right. I mean, you head off in yet another direction. Give us a quick thumbnail of Chewie's Course.
After Lifetime Loser was completed and Finish Line was completed, I still had a statement that I wanted to make and about society. And I think that after you have read the books, I am making statements about the world that we live in, whether or not they're social issues or the people that we come in face-to-face with are not what we think that they are. But, you know, those are the people that I try to create in my books. And my same doctor friend who suggested that I write that movie was reading Huckleberry Finn for the third or the fourth time, and he said, you know, Mark Twain created a character, this character, which was Jim, as we all well know, and he said, I've got to go back and read what he's saying three or four times just to understand what he was saying. And he said, it would be neat if you could create a character like that. Well, as you have found out after reading Chewie's Course, Chewie, obviously that's a nickname for him, but he was a minority businessman, and his battle in life was the establishment that was essentially discriminating against him. Chewie lived that life.
Indeed. And I have to go off on a wild tangent. Your doctor friend, would that be Dr. DV?
My doctor friend is a veterinarian, and I'd probably pattern, and I'd say all my characters are not particularly patterned after one person, but I bet they're patterned off of a combination of three or four people.
Yeah, I've heard that lots and lots of times. You know, my character is based in reality, but you know, it's not from one person. It's little bits of this person, little bits of that person.
Yeah, and I, you know, as you well know, I've got my cast of regulars that are in the pro shop there, and they're from various parts of life. And whether or not I've got eight, or some of them die, I end up adding, and they've become 12, or however many there are, I borrow a little bit here and there and everywhere, and that's just from observing life. But I want to make them memorable and distinct, and, you know, something that the reader can say, you know what, I think I know somebody like that.
Right. So you can tell your doctor friend that I've outed him. I have determined that he's Dr. DV in the book.
His secretary would say the same thing.
Too funny. Actually, I saw Chewie's Course as a bit of a return to the style of Lifetime Loser, very much a good versus bad situation.
That was another statement about society that we're all exposed to. And I think that as you've read the first three books, Simon, I think that you know that I'm making statements, or I'm at least portraying life in America and just doing it in my with my own style and my own way. But yeah, that's a statement about social issues, and that's something that is running through the fiber of our society. Yet it just depends on what side of the tracks, I guess, you're on, whether or not you can see it or not.
I was reading some internet comments. I live online, and I did some poking around on Tui's course, and I'm not so sure I buy into some of the comments. I'm not sure that I buy into the racially charged aspect. I see it more as a commentary on the haves and have-nots with a good dose of corruption thrown in.
You know what, then? I'm glad that you said that, because I think that that's more accurate. Even though you do probably see some racial aspect to it, or a discriminatory aspect to it, it's... I had to write it that way so that the, or I had to take that character that way. And when I say character, I'm referring to Tui. I had to take him that way just to show that we live in two different worlds. Depending on whether or not it's the world of that struggling minority businessman who's just trying to make a living for his family, or the establishment, which is dictating the rules to him, which in this particular book is City Hall. And I can imagine the frustrations, and we don't even have to make it a black-white issue, but I can imagine the struggle that that character had to go through just to try to accomplish the simple things in life, like putting food on the table.
I know that that there's going to be some listeners going, Tui? Tui? What on earth does that mean? Now... The actual spelling of the name is T-U-E-Y. Would you like to give us the explanation of how he got his name?
He got his name from a drug-induced mother who was probably being torn in a lot of different directions, and her mind was very messed up. But he was given three names: We Will Defeat, Ulysses, O'Tweedy, and each given name had two E's in it. So his nickname became Tui.
I don't know where you get your ideas from, but, I mean, they are so clever. You should be a teacher.
I do that. That's one of the things I do as well, but Simon, I might wake up in the middle of the night. I might be driving down the interstate. Who knows where they come from? But, the mind is a fascinating thing, really.
It is indeed. I have to admit that I do love your villains. I mean, that they are so delightfully despicable.
And the characters is what... is probably the most joyous thing about all of this, because as we look around us in everyday living, we see them.
There's a part in Tui's course where Tui goes to I think it's the City Hall meeting, and you offer a description of the council members and the various other people, and there are foxes and there are rats. it's just a great piece of descriptive writing.
Some people were upset at me because, and you've read my stories, they might take a while to get going. I don't know, some people want to have action on the first two paragraphs, but I want to lay the groundwork, and one of the things that I had to do with that particular book is I had to go into animal descriptions about the characters early on in that story because of how that would come into play in the latter stages of the book. But yeah, they, that's, I could, when I was writing that, I could just see, that on the big screen, and here's all these, city officials that basically look like animals.
Right.
So, that's kind of what I tried to describe.
I don't want to give away any spoilers, so I want you to be very careful how you answer this question. But when you sat down to write Tui's course, had you already figured out the ending of the book?
Yes. And when that went through the editing process, it changed.
Hmm.
And when I say that, Simon, I will say that I had I think that we will agree that Tui's course is probably an exercise in I'm going to say an exercise in dialect, which is what was one of the things that I wanted to do. But I also wanted to show a diversity in my writing style. And when we got into the final stages of that book, I had made it a lot more horrific than the way it turned out. But we had to edit some of the things, and it changed a little bit on the, in the tail end of it. But it, all in all, I was happy with the story and the message that was delivered through it.
Don't get me wrong here. I was just somewhat surprised by the ending. It didn't seem like the James Ross ending that I've grown to know and love. You know,
isn't that a part of writing though? Is you want to try to be unpredictable?
Oh, and you certainly are that.
I mean, I've had so many people come up and say, you know, they know what the ending is going to be after they read the first 30 pages. Well, okay, I guess that's fine and dandy, but what happens if it doesn't turn out the way they think it's going to turn out?
Okay, I'll tell you what. Let's do some shameless promotion. Where can people buy these great, great books?
I think we live in an online world right now. The online bookstores have them. We're all aware of those, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders, and everywhere else. With one click of the mouse, you can go to a lot of places these days. My first publisher was Ex Libris, which was I self-published the first three books. And then after the first three came out, I landed a larger publisher, which is Nightingale Press, which is we've just released that fourth book this summer, 5 or 6 weeks ago, and they'll be releasing my book that's due out in 2011, which is titled Pabby's Score. But certainly my publisher websites, Ex Libris and Nightingale Press, as well as the online bookstores.
And do you have a personal website?
Thank you for asking that. www.authorjamesross.com. is where people can go. We've got a PayPal situation there. The books have been converted to e-format, so anybody that has Kindle, the Nook, Steez Reader, or an iPad can purchase them in e-book format as well.
Mm. All right. What kind of reader feedback are you getting?
I think that's the toughest thing that I didn't figure on when I set out to write. I think the best way to handle that is you better consider it a labor of love and don't go into writing books to become a commercial success. And that's not to say that we're not starting to see sales. It's just that the marketing end of this business probably takes up 90% of the time, whereas the writing, which is a very difficult thing to do, is taking 10% of the time. So I guess what I'm trying to say is you know, everybody that writes a book thinks that the world's going to rush to read their masterpiece. Well, the world doesn't even know that they exist. I have talked to several authors, and virtually all of them have said the same thing. They have said that the world doesn't even know an author exists till he releases his fifth book. So I'm in that stage, Simon. I'm building my fans. I'm building my readership. The people that read it, which are largely female, believe it or not, love my stuff. I've developed some wonderful fans.
I won't say surprises me, but I do find it somewhat surprising. Whoops, I just said it. Female fans? I would have thought that they were more male centric books.
Oh, and the females love to read about men. When I think from a marketing standpoint, that's maybe where I made my first error was I said, oh, you know, I've got a golf course setting here. We're going to have all kinds of people from that like golf to come out and read these books. Well, then I realized something after trying that. Golfers don't read. Guys would rather go out and play golf than read a book. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not going to get on an airplane when they have a golf trip or something like that. They're going to take a book with them. But I've found that females read, and there's so many different genres right there out there now. And when I say paranormal and vampires and chick lit and sci-fi, but I'm in a whole different ball game, which is I'll call it realistic fiction with some drama in it, and I'm getting readers that want that genre, and they love the golf course setting because that is not out there. And then I think a lot of people are like you, Simon. After you pick up a book or two and read it, you find out that, you know, there's very little golf in these books.
Right. I mean, you tend to use the Prairie Winds golf course just merely as your backdrop. I mean, you explore human emotion. And you do it so well.
Well, and that's what I want to... The issues that I'm writing about are societal issues, societal hot buttons. And I can come back to Prairie Winds, which is where my family is that I've created, and that's my comfort zone. And I can come back there, and the people that have commentary, or I can deliver my commentary through their voices. And that's how that golf setting has all evolved. But as you well know, the themes that we're talking about are universal themes that we're all exposed to on a daily basis. Conversely, we've got... on the outside world, a lot of evil and vile people out there. And here we are in a golf course environment, which is really all about the gentleman's game, respect, honesty, integrity, and all the qualities that you really admire in somebody. So that's that core at Prairie Winds that, you know, has all the good qualities of life. That's what you see. It's a very relaxed setting, very relaxed atmosphere. These guys are on vacations. They're all good friends, and they all stick up for each other. You get outside those clubhouse doors, you enter society, and here comes all the junk that nobody likes. So,
but I have to disagree with you slightly. I mean, you do have the delightfully not very nice. I won't say he's a villain, because I don't think he is, but Captain Jer. I mean, he's not exactly the person that you want to invite over for Sunday dinner.
But isn't he a lot of fun to be around?
Oh, absolutely. he adds color. I think that's a good way of putting it.
Captain Jerry, St. Louis is a very... as time has evolved, St. Louis is a very big airport hub at one time in this country. And being raised here and from here, we had a lot of flights that came in and out of St. Louis. I had an opportunity to meet a lot of airline personnel. So he's a combination of a lot of people that I know, and you know, they're going to go out and have their booze, and they're going to have their fun and their good times, and it may not be somebody that you're going to bring home to meet your mom after Sunday school, but he's going to be a colorful guy with a lot of stories, and he's a liver of life.
Yes, indeed. So what are you actually doing in the way of marketing? Are you mostly using the internet, or you know, are you doing book signings, that kind of thing?
The book signings are hard to come by. What I've found, Simon, is that right now in the United States, we're looking at probably 700,000 to 800,000 books released on a yearly basis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe 5 to 10% of those actually get into bookstores. So bookstores would be nice, but if they have never heard of you, then nobody's going to go to the bookstore shelf and pick your book off the shelf and buy it. So what we're trying to do is get exposure through the internet primarily. I'm on all the social networking sites, Twitter, Facebook, several little book club sites, Shelfari, Goodreads, trying to develop a Google presence with the website. Obviously have online reviews. We're even doing some video trailers with YouTube and blog talk radio, things like that. So, yeah, a lot of internet exposure. The book signings, as nice as they sound, I don't know if they'd actually be that fruitful.
Oh, pick a golf course and a day when they have one of those big corporate deals.
And we've done some of those. I've donated some books for silent auctions and things like that. They tend to, like I say, golfers golf. And they don't want to sit around and talk about some book because they'd rather be out golfing. So, I mean, that's just sort of what I've found. Now, as a sidelight about all of this, the way this has evolved is I've been in touch with librarians and teachers. We discovered that there was a wonderful market out there for my books for the YA readers. And when I say YA, for those that don't know, that's the young adult readers. Typically, in talking to librarians and teachers, we found that virtually 80% of the books out there are written for teenage girls. And there's only a small portion, 20%, that are written for boys. So we found that because of the golf setting and the sports underlying setting, the boys are taking an interest in my stories. They can still read about the adult topics. Yet, I think that they're written, if you look at the Lexile and the accelerated reader measures, they're written on the fourth, fifth, sixth grade level. So that's a whole other market which we're going after, and we're starting to make some headway there.
That's great. I don't want to get into a deep discussion on your fourth book, Oprah's Blade, as I'll be honest with you, I haven't finished reading it. I'm only up to about page 60. And like an attorney in a courtroom, I hate to ask questions that I don't know the answer to. So I just want to ask a purely technical question. Oprah's Blade is significantly longer than your other books. I think it weighs in at 460-something pages. That kind of makes it a whopper. Why the change-up?
Okay, and I'm going to ask you something which you probably are aware of now that you're turning the pages. That's the first book with my new publisher. We single-spaced on the first book, or first three books. We double-spaced on this one.
Oh, okay. So, you know, in number of words, it's not significantly different.
that book, as you read it, will end up being the same length as Finish Line and Tui's Course. The longest book that I had by far was Lifetime Loser. But we decided to shorten them just a little bit rather than making... And they're all, you know, full-length novels. But, you know, when you get into a word count that's gets up there, then, you know, you better have one heck of a story or you're going to lose your readers.
Yes. Otherwise, you'll get the nickname of... who's that dreadful author that writes 1,000-page novels? Can't remember.
But you know what I'm talking about. It's just a long book is a long book, and I want to make they're all novel length, well over 100,000 words, but we don't have to make them so long. They, we lose the reader.
Oprah's Blade, and as I said, all I've done is merely scratched the surface. I made it up to about page 60, and then I had to come inside to talk to you. But it seems to me that it's a prequel rather than a follow-on to Tui's Course.
Let me see here. You're probably at the stage of it where, some of that happened prior to because I brought some characters back from Lifetime Loser.
Right.
But you're at the stage of the book that required that. As you move forward in that book is also going to take place over a 20-year period of time, and I had to go back and give some background information, which is where you're at with that book. That's another journey, and that we start out with a teenage boy, a 10 or 12-year-old boy, and we're going to follow him in through his teenage years and into his adult years. And I'll just, for lack of a better description, that's going to be my underdog story. He's going to have his journey, and he's going to have odds against him. But as you read further, you can see how he battles against those forces.
Yeah, well, like I said, I don't tend to ask questions I don't know the answer to, but you got me on that one.
Yeah, and I hope that didn't come. I don't think I exposed anything that you couldn't pick up off of back cover of the jacket either. So, I don't want to throw too much at you if you're still in the middle of reading the book.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you how I deal with the book. I look at the front cover, and believe it or not, the cover art is significant. Yeah, there are some books that you go, oh, I like that. Yeah, it kind of sets the tone, and then, unlike most people, I actually read the boring stuff about who the publisher is and blah blah blah, and that was how I noticed that, that there was a switch up in publishers. Oh, he's moved from Ex Libris or however they pronounce it this week, to Nightingale. And the back cover, that gets red at the very end. I don't like to color my thoughts.
And that's fine. With Oprah's Blade, as you well know by looking at that front cover, the front and center of that is that putter, and that's the in golfing vernacular, a putter is known as a blade, and so that's front and center on the front of that cover, and it's sitting in a lost and found barrel, which is where this particular character found that golfing apparatus, and that's what the story's about.
Indeed, and it took me a while to figure out the story, but the putter is slightly beaten up, and the boy goes, "Oh, this is great."
As any 10-year-old boy would, anything that's given to him, he thinks it's the best thing in the world. But it's just a cast-off club that nobody really claimed. But an expression that's known on the golf course to golfers is that your putter's gold. And in this particular case, that putter might be gold to that particular character.
I know that you're writing a fifth book. You mentioned the title earlier on. Do you want to share some information about that?
Pabby Score is scheduled for a 2011 release. That is, I'm going to combine internet dating with elements of dementia and autism. Some lovable characters in this particular story, but I've got a disdain for our justice system, and there's going to be elements of justice, and it's probably going to be a return to the Lifetime Loser sort of story.
When you say 2011, are we talking January 1?
Oh, that the rate that I'm going, I'm already about 5 months behind. I think we're probably looking at sometime summer to fall of 2011 for that book.
Oh, James, you're going to have to write faster.
Yeah, it's, and Simon, somebody asked me how long it takes to write a book, and I would say that, an author, at least I can probably write one if I sat down and wrote it. I could probably write a novel in 2 to 3 months. Uninterrupted, really, really focused, really going. Unfortunately, that's not the way life is for all of us. We get distracted. We do get writer's block as authors. But for instance, after having said all that, you read Finish Line. I wrote the last half of Finish Line in 3 weeks. You can, if you get focused, get uninterrupted, really get on the right train of thought and get your fingers going, you can pound out a novel. One a year is my goal. Whether or not it takes me 8 months or 18 months, I'm going to try to release one a year and try to stay creative like that.
Okay, my producer is whining in my ear that I need to wrap this interview up. I want to really, really thank you for taking time out to talk with me today. And I know I speak for everyone at Blogger News in wishing you every success with all of your books. And I'm also hoping that once I finish your latest book, Oprah's Blade, I can lure you back for another interview.
Simon, I'd love the opportunity. I really want to thank you for having me today, and I'll put one last plug in for anybody that would like to read my stories. Go to www.authorjamesross.com.
All right. James, till next time, you be good, be safe, and happy writing.
Thanks, Simon.
Okay, talk to you again. Bye.
Bye-bye.